And yes, our special guest tonight is David Wilcock. We're going to be back with him more as we talk about how this all ties into 2012, then open up phone lines, and you can chat with him too. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Back with David. David, let's move on a little bit here and tie this into global warming and what you also believe might be happening again throughout the solar system.
Absolutely.
How does this all tie in?
Well, essentially, my model, which is validated by a variety of top secret reports that seem to go back to the even as late as the 50s, but even maybe the 40s, is that there's strong evidence that our governments have been aware that we're moving into a domain of energy in the galaxy that is a higher energetic charge, and that that would have certain noticeable effects on every planet throughout the solar system, which we are now seeing. We are seeing huge increases in the brightness of planets and moons, the magnetic field strength, the amount of storm activity, even the rotation speed of Saturn is changing. And we put together over 100 different references on this in the paper that I wrote with Richard Hoagland called Interplanetary Day After Tomorrow. And you can basically ask me if you want to any planet, and I'll give you a list of specific details of that planet in terms of what it's changing like.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Because does that also have a bearing, or does that tell us exactly why it's happening here?
Well, I certainly would not be hasty to propose that we not try to curb our carbon emissions. However, there's no SUVs on these planets. There's no industrial pollution, and yet they're changing just like our planet.
Yeah, if anything, maybe even faster.
That's true. Pluto is moving away from the sun, but it's actually experiencing global warming, even though it's supposedly moving into a colder region of space. And it's like that on every planet. I mean, Neptune has gotten 40% brighter in the near-infrared range of the spectrum just between 96 and 2002 in a six-year period, 40% brightness increase.
More and more scientists are, and I'm seeing this now, David, and as you know, I believe that global warming is real, caused by Earth cycles.
Right.
And it's been here, it's going to be here. More and more scientists seem to be jumping on that bandwagon. They're changing their mind. But I don't know why they're changing their minds. I mean, they took the posture that it was all man-made. Now they're slowly coming around. How come?
Well, it just has to do with the sheer weight of evidence. The Great Global Warming Swindle is that UK documentary that probably everybody's seen on this show, which makes very compelling cases for long-term cycles, which I believe are called Milankovitch cycles, that basically drive warming on the Earth. And in fact, so this is nothing new. The climate is constantly in a state of fluctuation. And when you start seeing it throughout the whole solar system, we've seen Abdusamatov, this guy who is written up in National Geographic comparing global warming on the Earth to Mars. There's been a few other guys who have kind of made some tentative steps to link this together. But it would appear, and this gets into what Richard is going to be talking about in part tomorrow night on tomorrow night's show about NASA, it would appear that NASA is distinctly aware of what's going on, and there's been a moratorium on discussing it. And so I would be inclined to say that it's not so much that they're discovering it as much as what they're being allowed to talk about. You know, Robert Hansen recently came forward and was explaining that the White House was censoring hundreds of press releases of the science of global warming and specifically trying to eliminate references that suggested that something is really happening, so that it always stayed sort of vague. And we also, in the honeybee collapse article that Richard and I put together, the first part of it, we cited the scientist from NASA who was working on the gas around the solar system on the outside, and explaining that NASA had a persistent, pernicious bias against him doing this research. Now, pernicious, if you look it up, means deadly, evil, and insidious. So why would some guy doing this obscure research about how thick are the clouds of energy around the solar system on the outside, why would he be getting death threats from NASA if he publishes this research, which may be showing that the gas is getting thicker? And in fact, there is research that shows that now.
You would think that they'd welcome his work.
No kidding. But in fact, it appears that if you start getting into the Black Ops whistleblower testimony, which is another area we could do whole shows on, I've had the privilege of meeting multiple witnesses, some of whom have said that NASA has been well aware of this for a long time, and they basically know that it's happening in 2012. 2012 is a final sort of crossing point.
Devastating in 2012?
That's what they think, yes. That's what they think. And it's very interesting. If you went to the movies a few months ago, there was a film that came out called The Last Mimsy, M-I-M-Z-Y.
Did not see The Last Mimsy.
Did you see that?
I did not.
Oh. Well, you know, a lot of people have tried to discredit Dan Burrish as one witness who I've had extensive conversation with on the phone, on email, etc. And yet The Last Mimsy is like a precise parroting of almost everything that he said. Now, one could argue that they were just drawing off of his story for Hollywood script ideas, which is certainly possible.
Sure.
But you start seeing the same data surfacing over and over again. And by the way, I actually did get a message on an email from Burrish tonight, and he said he would be willing to do the show again.
Let's do it.
Very good.
Would,
so
let's do, you know, is, would you also tell him his mother's looking for him?
Yeah. Yeah, we. That's a long story.
Yeah, I know, but it is his mother.
I know. And, I know. Well, Dan is a very interesting guy, you know, and I have a lot of respect for him. It was actually through him that I discovered that all this work I was putting together in terms of the physics was actually well known on the inside.
For people who don't know who we're talking about, he worked in bioscience in the Area 51 section in Nevada.
That's correct.
He is no longer there. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And he's
However,
in hiding,
he is still
right?
an adjunct member of Majestic.
Is he in hiding?
No.
He's not in hiding. Well, how come his mother can't find him then?
That
you don't want to get into
you
it.
You want to ask him when you get him on the show.
All right.
I guess, you know, he just wanted to say that he feels like this is tough to say, but he wants to be treated with respect, and I guess he was emotionally triggered the last time he was on. But, you know, I think we can come to an agreement. I think it's important that everybody hear his perspective because it actually is positive. Now, the Burrish story, on the surface of it, a lot of people have taken it and ran with it in a doomy direction. But he actually doesn't really say that. Now, it is true that from his perspective, the Roswell crash were time travelers from our future, after a microgenetic evolution, which is exactly the model that I've been building up to here with these galactic energy zones. So maybe we should talk about that a little bit because we don't want to stray too far from the 2012 model. I think, George, it's a brilliant idea that you've had to sort of start orienting a focus, a sequence. With Jay Wiedner also kind of was suggesting this last week that a sequence of shows – because this is only 5.5 years away.
I know it. It's coming up fast, David. And if it has the kind of potential calamity that we're all beginning to think, I mean, you know, here we are having astronomers and meteorologists, astrometeorologists, beginning to say, look, we think the sun is going to have a major change around 2011, 2012. I mean, that's pretty darn strange, David.
Well, this is the solar maximum, and I remember when Jay was on your show, Jay Wiedner, he was explaining how an even solar minimum has broken all the records, like so far beyond anything that's been expected. In 2003, there was a solar flare that was at X40, which they didn't even have a scale for. They've actually had to rebuild satellites because the satellites weren't even built to handle the amount of solar energy that's coming out. So then when you start reading ancient scriptures from the Hindu Vedas, where they talk about something called the Somvarta fire, S-O-M-V-A-R-T-A, the Somvarta fire at the end of an age, what are they talking about?
I'll tell you how much I've changed, David. When I first came into this program, I said, I believe, you know, I got this little intuitive gut myself, though I wasn't Edgar Cayce. I may have been something else, maybe Edgar's pool boy or something. But, you know, I came into this saying that I believe 2012 will be an age of enlightenment, that there was nothing was going to happen of any calamity, and that, you know, it was going to be a good period for the world. And as I have evolved into this program, I don't think that way anymore about that. It's not that I'm enlightened or spiritual or anything like that. It's just that I think the Mayans weren't that new agey, that esoteric. They were real science. And I think something is going to happen, and I think it's based around the sun and the solar system.
Well, yeah, I would just encourage someone to suggest that the bachelor's degree is Armageddon, the PhD is ascension, and you have to do a lot more research to get to the PhD and be able to prove it scientifically than to get your bachelor's degree. And I don't mean that in any way to sound insulting, and if it does, I apologize. But I do not believe that we are dealing with an Armageddon scenario, specifically because...
I hope you're right.
You got to understand, my work created ripples in the Black Ops community because they're saying, how does this kid figure all this stuff out? How does he know what he knows? I've had a number of high-ranking people come to me and say, we don't know how you figured this out, man. Now, nobody has paid me or taken me into any kind of secret oath or anything like that. In fact, I was invited into a quasi-Illuminati sister group at one point. I turned it down.
Why did you go, just to infiltrate it?
Because it's not a milieu you want to be messing with, considering the hypnotic drugs they have and the ritual stuff that goes on. I would not want to... I mean, I know at the higher levels, they kind of look down on what they call the slicers and dicers, and they kind of sit through those rituals the same way that somebody might sit through Catholic Mass, and they're not really
Catholic. And you could get drawn into that. You've got that kind of personality.
Well, I have been through so much initiation in my life that, I watched my girlfriend get hit by a car and shoot 30 feet through the air.
Oh, my God, Dave.
A week after we had just gotten back from Dr. Greer's Disclosure Project conference. During which, on the way to the conference, I lost the brakes on my car and almost had a head-on collision in D.C. rush hour traffic. I've had attempts on my life. I watched her body in the hospital as it was being wheeled into the ER
for emergency surgery.
So I've seen everything.
Is she okay? Did she make it?
Yeah, she survived. In fact, she ended up doing better at the end than in the beginning. But the point is that during that time, I was able to read and start researching about the Illuminati in terms of the real nitty-gritty of the rituals that they've done. And there is a certain point at which you become sort of conditioned to reading about some of these heinous acts of torture on other human beings. And it's not that I would ever want to participate in them, but I also, there's really nothing you can show me or tell me that would shock me anymore.
I had a chance to talk with Ron Paul, who's running for the presidency on the Republican side. He wants to get the nomination. He may be one of the few candidates who has an undertone of belief that the Illuminati exists, that the Illuminati is out to manipulate this planet and will do whatever it has to do. And though, we didn't talk specifically about that, I think he believes that.
I would certainly agree insofar as there have been an ongoing tradition of people on the inside who know about this. The one augmentation I would give is that there are actually two groups, major groups, and many splinter groups, but two major groups that are decidedly opposed to each other but begrudgingly work together. The Illuminati is primarily a European, Luciferian-based group in which they had these ancient mystery traditions, and they were persecuted by Christians. Therefore, they said, well, whoever the Christians threw out of heaven must be the good guy because we know that we had the right stuff going before they ever even came along. So they kind of adopted a Luciferian philosophy. Now, the elements of the neocon side, which you could consider the New World Order or Majestic, are very anti-Illuminati, actually, and there is a war going on. And it's a war behind the scenes in which, for example, they do not want to allow one world government to happen because on the Illuminati side, they want this sort of antichrist world leader to emerge. And so the Majestic makes sure that there's never going to be a one world government, specifically to avoid that prophecy from happening. Anyway, that's another long discussion and a big side tangent from what we're trying to talk about.
All right, so you don't believe, though, in the calamity of 2012. I think it's possible.
Oh, I'm not saying that there's not going to be a physical calamity. I absolutely think there will be.
All right, what are you saying, then?
What I'm saying is that it's sort of like when you see a ship that comes out of the Bermuda Triangle and there's nobody on the ship, but there's still eggs frying on the stovetop, there's just no evidence of people on the ship.
Yeah, but it's still weird. It's still strange. You know something happened.
Absolutely.
Saying the ship didn't get destroyed.
I'm saying that biological life, as opposed to rough physical matter, has an interdimensional quality that is not well appreciated, but which all of these Russian studies of DNA are giving us glimpses of the fact that, you know, when you accelerate the molecular vibration, the actual speed of the atomic action, past light speed, which can be done, that you reach something they call in Black Ops crescendo, which I only learned recently. And once you hit crescendo, you sort of phase over into a parallel universe, which is where ghosts exist. It's where you go when you dream. It's where you go when you die. And there are people over there, and you can live over there. And it's a whole parallel universe that coexists with our own. And it's sort of like pushing a beach ball down below the surface of a pool of water. The beach ball appears to not exist from our vantage point, which is above the surface of the water. But if you look under the water, it's there. Now, one of the interesting experiments that would show this is David Hudson, who's into the Ormus elements, the monatomic elements. And he took monatomic iridium and heated it up to 800 degrees Celsius, whereupon this substance, a special version of iridium, would disappear from physical visible sight, and the weight would disappear from the scale it was on. Only when you kept that area that it was in hot, above 800 degrees Celsius, when you cooled the area back down, the monatomic iridium reappeared and regained its mass. Okay?
That's weird.
So what that means is that when you get to monatomic elements, you're dealing with a geometric structure, a harmonic structure in the way the elements are constructed. That harmonic geometry allows for something as simple as temperature, which is just a vibration, to actually cause it to move past light speed very easily once you get above a critical temperature. When you move it above light speed, it displaces, like the balloon or the beach ball going under the surface of the water, it displaces into a higher dimension. To us, it appears to disappear. But over there, it appears. That's why a lot of times when you see these earth lights, these like in Hesdale in Norway, they keep winking in and out of existence, but if you look at them in infrared, they keep existing the whole time. It's just that they keep becoming visible and invisible. So similarly, there's a lot of anecdotal black ops data, which is not credible in the sense of science yet, but it all points towards Stargate phenomena in which the body can warp into these other planes of existence and return undamaged.
Why can't we travel that way then?
Well, it's not that we can't. It's that it's not being openly used. You know, the Philadelphia experiment was an accident that was based on initially a discovery that was made from very high-intensity arc welding of the hulls of battleships in Norfolk Naval Shipyard. They discovered by filming this phenomenon that the tools that were showing up missing after they did these enormous arc welds were going through this black hole that would appear in the room. So then they studied this more and were able to create a containment field around a ship, which initially was only for radar and visibility.
What? Now, are you saying as they were repairing ships with the welding and the arcing, somehow this created some kind of hole or portal?
That's correct.
And the equipment that they would have would sometimes fall into it or disappear?
Right. Tools would disappear, and they didn't know where they went. And at first they didn't think there was anything going on, but when they actually filmed tools physically dematerializing and these black holes showing up in the room, that's when they said, wow, we've got something very strange going on here.
What about the welder, the military type who was working on the ship?
They did lose some personnel, especially once the Philadelphia experiment was conducted. Now, this gets into a whole other interesting area of stargates where the technology has been used to create jump gates that have open wormholes.
All right, I got to talk with you about stargates when we come back. That is amazing. David Wilcock, our guest. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. Plus, we're going to talk with David about his new movie. He's moved to Los Angeles. He's a neighbor of ours. About Convergence. We'll be back. After Dark Newsletter, where you get 14 issues for the price of 12 by calling 1-888-727-5505, or you can go online at coasttocoastam.com. Okay, David, let's run with this incredible story you've been talking about now, Stargate and Portals. Explain, please.
Well, this gets into time travel as well. I actually had extensive contact with someone who claims to have worked on the Montauk project. Now, this is not Swerdlow or Bielik or Preston Nichols or anybody who's come forward. This guy chooses to go by the pseudonym Daniel, and he has not come forward, except to me. And
how did you find him, if you can tell us?
Well, short, quick version, because we don't have a lot of time, is that I got stranded in Albany visiting my mother one winter at the Albany airport.
That happens in Albany.
And I had to take a little shuttle bus to a hotel, and I was hungry. I was planning on eating when I got to her house, and I ended up going to a Denny's. And I had brought this Montauk Project book with me basically almost as a joke, because I'd bought it years ago and thought that it was all completely, you know, ridiculous. And I'm reading it in the Denny's, and this guy walks by who actually looked like a biker. I mean, he had a big burly beard, and he had a leather jacket on, and, dingy denim pants. And this dude says, so are you you're interested in that, huh? I said, well, not really. He said, well, I worked at Montauk. And I just laughed. And
to yourself?
Well, no.
I mean, really? All right.
I was trained in martial arts, so I'm
take
not
it. Oh, okay, myself. Okay, all right.
But you know, I mean, I laughed, and I just, it was just a very natural, spontaneous reaction, and he kept on going with it, and I just started to ask him questions, and the next thing I knew, after you know about 20 minutes of interrogation, I realized that, you know, something really happened to this guy. He's not lying, and I've since been able to have multiple long interactions with him. And he described that there was a seat that came out of one of these ships. And to make a long, long story short, they hooked it up to a very, very high-intensity power supply and found that if you did something called zeroing out the chair, which meant there were like 22, something like that, wavelengths coming from somebody's mind when they're meditating, you try to get to a place they call quiet point where you have no mental activity. And then they would flatten out all these sine wave graphs that would be the description of your mind. And once they flatten them out and they zero out the chair, as it's called, then whatever you think would manifest in the room, supposedly. Now, this includes, like, materialization of objects as physical things. It also included, you know, scary mind control stuff. But more importantly, when you thought about a particular place, portals would appear in the room that you could actually send people through. In many cases, they didn't make it, but in a lot of cases, they would, and you could go to another place. It was only later in the project that they discovered that, you know, that they were actually able to go through time as well as space. And this sounds completely outlandish. However, what we're coming to understand is that this parallel reality I was speaking of before the break is a domain where space and time are completely inverted. In other words, here we have what appears to be, according to Einstein, one dimension of time, which basically just moves forward like a river, and we have three dimensions of space. Well, that one dimension of time is the only one we can see, but time is actually three-dimensional. And there's a system of physics from Dewey-Larson called reciprocal system, where if you actually attack time as being three-dimensional, which gets into Richard's hyperdimensional physics,
right,
then you can solve all the problems of quantum physics very easily. But the deal is this. If you transition yourself over to time-space and you walk 10 feet in time-space and then you re-enter here without going back to the point that you started from, so like if you walk 10 feet and then you don't go back to where you started, you will have traveled in time when you come back over to this side of the fence. Now, that's why in the ancient legends of the fairy circles, they say it's very important if you enter a fairy ring in which, you know, when you go through on the other side, you see these little people like gnomes and fairies and dwarves and so forth. that you have to go back into the fairy circle the way you went in the first time, or else you will actually travel in time. That's in a lot of these old medieval grimoires. So it appears, from what he was telling me, that when you basically hyper-accelerate somebody's vibration to this higher dimension, that they can move over there, and what is a physical movement in space over there is a movement in time over here. So that when you crank yourself back down into our time, into our side of the fence of these two domains, you know, space-time and time-space, when you come back, you've actually traveled in time. Now, apparently, they found a 20-year wave, a sine wave, that came out from the printouts of the chair, because the chair had hundreds and hundreds of different graphs that could be printed out. And this 20-year wave apparently is related to the harmonics of the Earth's vibration. And they were able to precisely calculate where in time somebody was by how far along this sine wave went.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And this is not stuff I've ever heard from any other Montauk witnesses. What they found was that on exactly December 21st, 2012, all of the hundreds of wavelengths that the chair would crank out went flatline for like 5 or 6 seconds. Now, all these dudes that were at the top levels of this program, they were salivating to try to get that data, because during that exact moment that people were traveling through what looked like basically a wormhole, like you see in Contact at the end of the movie,
mm-hmm.
or in Stargate SG-1, for example, during that time, it's like you get thumped really, really hard by an energy, like you hit a wall of energy, basically. And they call it the bump. And they also called it the full out. And when you hit this wall, you experience cosmic consciousness. You feel as if you know everything. You're complete ecstasy, spiritual ecstasy. You could be like the size of the galaxy, the size of an atom. Everything you'd ever want to know is there. It's complete euphoria. You have no sense of time passing. And then also, Daniel's research concluded that anything that you see after 2012 is completely based on the prejudices of the person running the chair and the prejudices of the person who is seeing the experience.
Really?
In other words, it seems to be a wrinkle in time where you have to pass through this point where all the graphs would go flatline, and then, you know, they could never get that data, but that's what they wanted, because they wanted to play it back through the chair without somebody in it and then try to go through it themselves if they could get it to a point where it was systematic. See, a lot of these guys didn't want to go through the chair themselves because they didn't want to lose their lives, but they were really, you know, seriously wanting to know what was happening when people hit this bump in 2012. And that's also ties in with Burrish's material, where it appears on his from his information that there's this surge of energy from the center of the galaxy and from the sun that bombards us with what Burrish calls micro wormholes, which actually have a stimulating effect on DNA. And I have a whole huge amount of science on that, and we can talk about the product that I have at the end of the show, where I talk about that. But importantly here is the idea that it seems as if this 2012 event, all of the black ops stuff that I'm hearing that seems the most credible, keeps saying the same thing, which is that the physical vibration of matter as we know it, which is ultimately geometric, and that's another long, we could do a whole show on that with Richard Hoagland and myself, about the geometry of the quantum field, of quantum physics. Geometry can change shape by increasing its frequency. It can change from one form to another. And physical matter can do that. That's why these objects are disappearing, like in the Philadelphia experiment with the arc welding, as I said, with the monatomic iridium when you raise it above 800 degrees Celsius, with Bermuda Triangle, where you have whole fleets of planes that just disappear, with no flotsam, no wreckage, no oil on the surface of the ocean. They just are gone.
Do they ever come back?
Sometimes they do. There was one guy who went through the Bermuda Triangle and said that he went into a green mist and lost all of his navigational instruments and felt very strange. And in his case, he actually managed to come out alive. There are other people who have seen strange vortexes of clouds that they flew through. And there's actually a case of a Korean Airlines jet, a 747, that was lost radar contact for 10 minutes. And they're sitting there in the cockpit of the plane listening to the control tower, and they had no perception that time had elapsed. 1 minute, They're talking to the control tower. Everything's fine. Then all of a sudden, everybody in the control tower is screaming, "What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? Are you okay? Are you okay?" Well, they said, "What are you talking about? We were just talking to you a minute ago." And they said, "No, you've been dead air for 10 minutes. Well, then, when everybody landed, every single clock and timepiece on the entire plane was 10 minutes off. So they just stepped
That's
out
weird.
Of time, as we know it, for 10 minutes. And when they came back, their clocks had not advanced, but our time had. So this is one of the really strange new physics things that we've had to learn, is that time is locally variable. You can have these Russian devices called torsion field generators in which you can actually change the flow of time to the point that you can take an ordinary watch or timepiece and have its measurement of time change when you zap it with this field.
What if something goes wrong, David? Could you destroy this space-time continuum? Could you send someone hurtling into space, never to be seen again?
That is one of the concerns that was had back during the Oppenheimer years with the atomic bomb testing, specifically because in an atomic explosion, there is sort of a warp field in hyperdimensional sense that's created, which they were wondering if it would have sort of a spontaneous dimensional collapsing effect. Now, if we gate back into my heritage as Edgar Cayce reincarnated, allegedly, and the work that I've done with higher forms of consciousness in terms of direct communication with them, even to the fact that some of my clients have had entities appear in the room, like, you know, robed beings that look like humans but are luminous, during the time that they were having a reading from me. And I certainly would not say that if they hadn't said it to my face that this was true. So, I believe very strongly that we are moving through a very protected game. In other words, this is not a situation where random apocalypse could happen to us. There are forces out there that are protecting us from disaster. And that goes back to Greer's Disclosure Project in 2001, which I was there for, the closed executive summary briefing for members of Congress and VIPs on May 10th, 2001.
That was at the National Press Club, that one?
It was the day after that, yeah.
Okay.
And it was a closed briefing. And that's where Sergeant Clifford Stone actually broke down crying, which was much more intense than the one that he gave to the National Press Club that you can actually watch on YouTube. And I met him that day and spoke to him personally. And, I mean, you know, you can tell this guy had really seen UFO entities up close. But one of the important things that came out of that experience for me was all these testimonies about nuclear missiles being completely disarmed by UFOs. Now, the military has to achieve complete confidence that anything that could be a threat has been dealt with as a possible threat. So, therefore, if a UFO hovers over a missile installation, powers down the whole installation, they have to see it as a hostile action. But given the fact that these guys seem to be a lot older than we are and a lot more ethical than we are, I would be inclined to say that they're actually protecting us. And I've had a lot of information. I mean, I have thousands of pages of free material on my website, divinecosmos.com.
Well, they're protecting us, David, but I also believe there must be something in the universe that can be disrupted if there's an atomic hit like that.
Oh, yeah. No question. It creates all sorts of problems, not just for our plane of existence, but for these other planes in time space. That's why supposedly the nuclear Armageddon will not be permitted, because it would disrupt other forms of life whose free will would not be aligned with our own. So it really does seem, when you get into the big cosmic picture of things, that we're in a very carefully crafted game whose purpose is soul evolution. And we're here on Earth now where we have negative things we can look at and we have positive things we can look at. We can see death in one hand, we can see life in the other hand. And these cosmic beings are designed to balance the spectrum so that the death side never gets more overpowering than the life side.
Now, David, go ahead, finish up, and then take a few minutes to tell me about what you're doing with the film.
Oh, great. It does start to sound like an evangelical message. I understand that. I'm not trying to say that I'm a fundamentalist or anything like that, but I do believe that a lot of the principles of the Christian religion are right on in terms of the science. You can take a DNA molecule – and have somebody hold it in their hands and think a certain emotion like hatred, and the DNA will shrink up and become like a braid of hair. If that same person thinks a thought of love, the DNA unwinds and extends in length, and when it unwinds, it can become accessible by your body for healing. So this is sort of like the equation of cancer and anger.
I'm now, a huge believer in that. Huge believer in that.
So this all gets back to the idea that DNA is an antenna for consciousness. Now, the film that I'm doing, Convergence the movie, is designed to be a Da Vinci Code style mystery thriller with a regular plot, not a talking head documentary, but we're going to have that on the DVD as a special feature. It probably won't be out until the end of next year. We are still at this point considering financing from various sources. We've actually turned down some sources already because they weren't in alignment with what we want to do.
You didn't like the deal?
Well, it's a complicated story, and I...
Come on, David. I know Hollywood now. You turn down a deal, it's because you don't like the offer. They wanted too much of the film, right?
Well, that's part of it. And frankly, one of these guys was from the Illuminati. And, you know, I can't really give away a whole lot more than that, except to say that he said there's trillions and trillions of dollars available. And, you know.
But they wanted to control what you said.
Well, yeah. I mean, they make it sound really good. And, like, you know, well, all you have to do, you know, we'll just move some money around in the bank for you, and then you can get this, and it's no big deal, you know. But, of course, and the backside of it is that there's a pitchfork, and, you know, they have to get their cut.
The and pitchfork.
Creative control. So, but anyway, what initially started the film was I had been on Coast. This is my seventh appearance. And a guy contacted me who was a 9-time Grammy Award-winning musician.
All right.
And he said, I want to do some music with you. I said, well, that's fantastic. So I went to his place in January 2005, delivered 3 CDs worth of lectures on this material about consciousness science, the consciousness field, DNA, soul evolution, 2012, what we can do to prepare for it. And we put an entirely original music soundtrack behind that. And that's called The Science of Peace, and it's available on my website, divinecosmos.com. It's a download link. Once you order it, you get an email. You have 3 days to download it. I would not recommend trying to download it tonight because it's going to get really jammed. But any time within the next 3 days is fine. If you can't download it, just send us an email. We'll give you another download link. But anyway, that in turn turned into the film, and I did more research for the film. Then it got bottlenecked for 2 years. I couldn't release the Science of Peace series, even though it was this wonderful thing with all this great music. The lawyers were saying it was too similar to the film's content. Thankfully, we've been through 5 rewrites of our script to get to this point where we have a wonderful screenplay now. And as a result of that, it's now changed enough that the material on Science of Peace, which gets into the real practical things we can do to help the planet and help raise our own consciousness, now I can release that. So I feel really good about that.
And you believe so much in the project. You moved to Los Angeles, right?
Yeah. I mean, I gave a lecture on Valentine's Day evening at the Science of Mind Church in L.A. There was a guy there in a crowd of about 13 people who was having his mouth hang open the whole time I was lecturing. It was all scientific. And, you know, if callers want to know more about this consciousness science in the next hour, we can certainly go into that. But the point is that he comes up to me at the end. He says, I'm a Hollywood producer. I've worked with Burt Reynolds, Sylvester Stallone, Dolly Parton, Dennis Quaid, yada, yada, yada. And I would love to do a film with you. So he met me at the Hilton Hotel the next morning where I was staying for a conference. And I said, one of the first things I said in the meeting is, like, good God, I'm going to have to move to L.A., aren't I? And he said, yeah.
And you did. David, we'll be back in a moment. We'll open up the phone lines now. I know we've thrown a lot at you, but we'll take your questions next. On Coast to Coast AM, I'm George Norrie.